coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back. On today's Worth Doing Badly, David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen will look at the lessons for Palm Sunday. And they are Deuteronomy 32 verses 36 to 39, Psalm 118 verses 19 to 29, Philippians 2 verses 5 to 11, and the Gospel according to Luke chapters 22 and 23. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen.
We've come finally to the end of Lent, to Palm Sunday. And this really is, you know, Palm Sunday is the culmination, well, I won't say the culmination of the season of Lent, but it at the very least sets the tone for the culmination of the season of Lent, which is the rest of Holy Week and the great 3 days. All of Christ's life and ministry has been leading to this point when he'll enter Jerusalem for the last time. Now, David, I don't know what your experience has been in the parish. I know it varies from congregation to congregation, what the practices of Holy Week are. And I think that's actually a very good thing, that each congregation can make how they observe Holy Week their own thing. But I see it especially liturgically as an opportunity to pull out all the stops and really make this time of the church year the distinctive time that it is. And I think it's a time, an opportunity to engage the congregation in ways that you don't see the rest of the year. You can make them move like we do with the palm processions. You have the movement around the altar for the stripping of the altar. Some congregations I know carry a large cross in on Good Friday. And then you have the gathering around the fire at Easter Vigil. So there's such a variety of things that you can do to engage the body and the mind and the voice as well. And the voice is what I will lean into here on Palm Sunday, because as I believe most churches do, we will be reading the Passion according, we'll read it according to Luke. I know some will use the combined version that combines all of the Gospels, but we'll read from the Gospel of Luke. And what I hope to do is use a few of my elders as readers and to read a few of the parts and then have the congregation read the parts of the crowd, which I think can be a very effective way, one, in making the congregation pay attention, but also it entrenches the congregation in the narrative. And in a way that preaches, right? That all of this preaches, all of the physical movement, the liturgies, all of that takes the people and puts them into the narrative of Scripture. As they hold their palms and read the shouts of the crowds, it's interpreting the text for them so that it's not just a far away event that they're remembering, but it's something that's being relived even now in the moment. So, David, have you actually preached on Palm Sunday?
Well, let me just say before that, I think the big mistake in my mind that I cringe at are the what I consider the showman pastors that want to create an experience. And by an experience, they want to have some kind of emotional response to the crucifixion. And I think that is a big mistake, because the whole of Lent and then the whole of Holy Week is aimed at paying attention to what Jesus is doing and not fixing the focus on the inner self of the believer, right? And so... Mm-hmm. And so I like what you're saying is I need help to pay attention to this text. And anything that can help me, hear what's going on. And I like what you say that when a story is really doing its work, you're not looking at the story, you're being drawn into it. And I think that's what I think the gospel writers recognize that this is not a story that you can just be aloof in. It wants to draw you in, and as you do, that can be done ritually and liturgically. And so, yes, I can't remember that I have ever done one sermon. Usually I break it up and do little reflections, because I would like, I know myself, if it's read all at once, I'm not going to pay attention. And I want to pay attention to this, right? So, and what you're saying is scattering the readings among other people, maybe read in different parts of the church. But as long as, you know, you're not judging the benefit of this by the emotional response of the worshipers, I think that puts a huge burden on people to have an experience. Whereas what we're doing is we're just paying attention to the text that all of reality flows from, of our reality as believers. So Right. That's my long answer to your question.
Well, and that's, I think you're spot on, right? That when we can, good preaching, you know, almost falls to the background, and it's not. I greatly appreciate the idea that, you know, we're not here to evoke an emotional response, and any preacher that tries to do that in his preaching, I think, is just going to be exhausted and disappointed week after week, and so with Holy Week, I agree, it is about attention, right? And paying attention. And you can structure the day in such a way that everyone can continue to, you know, be attentive in our time when it's just so hard to actually do that. And it actually, you know, when it comes to preaching, from my perspective, I give one homily, that's usually only about 5 minutes. And between the readings, I do stanzas of hymns, so in many ways, those preach as well, and help, you know, you have, oh, Sacred Head, Now Wounded, you know, that gets woven in between, each of the readings as on Good Friday. But when I preach, you know, when you have such a high level of a sweeping story to preach on, I find it helpful to focus in on one theme or even one word. And what this will actually do is it'll set the tone for the rest of Holy Week for
me. Okay, so what's that word or theme? This is what I've been dying to hear.
That word for me is betrayal.
Okay.
And so this Greek word, paradidomi, didomi meaning to give, para, being close, beside, you know, you're handing something over. And, you know, that's, I think Luke's gospel, more so than the others, makes use of that word and in its various ways, but at the same time, it's very pointed to actually get us to pay attention. I'll probably ask for your help to help shape this a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll just say right here, this is what I appreciate about the words of institution. It is saying that the betrayal is the setting that ties everything together. You know, when the Lord's Supper begins with, on the night he was betrayed, that's not just a throwaway line. That is, as you're saying here, the heart and center of everything.
Well, it's the heart and center of everything in more ways than just Judas's betrayal. Because even from the second verse of the whole gospel, you have this word used as the handing over of the gospel, right? The eyewitness accounts that are delivered by the ministers of the word. So I'm just going to run through a few of the points in the gospel where the word pops up, and hopefully that can feed a little bit of our understanding of Judas' own betrayal. So you've got the handing over of the gospel, then you have the handing over of the Father. When the Father is handing over all things to Jesus says, all things have been handed over to me by the Father, And then he goes on to say that no one is going to receive this unless the Son reveals. No one's going to receive the Father unless the Son reveals him. And this connects well because it's in the context of Jesus teaching the 12 and the well-known passage, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me." And so learning from Jesus is done by handing, you know, you receive the Father, but at the same time, there's this self-giving, you know, of taking up one's yoke, of taking up the yoke of Christ and bearing his cross. And so there's sort of this dynamic handing over back and forth that happens in sort of a self-giving nature, which is set in contrast with Judas's betrayal, which is a selfish betrayal, right? It's grounded in greed. So you have the handing over then of the disciples. Jesus reveals to the disciples that they will be handed over to the synagogues and prisons by their friends and family and be put to death. And Judas seems to be, I like to think of it this way, Judas seems to be the guy who realizes that it's true and wants to avoid it. And so he seeks to hand over to give over Jesus to the chief priests and the scribes. And of course, Jesus has prophesied this, has foretold this many times, and it's going to happen to at the hand of Judas. That's where you have all of this, these handings over throughout the whole gospel have been self-giving up to this point, whereas now Judas's his act of betrayal is self-serving, self-seeking. And it stands in contrast then to the givenness of the kingdom.
It's that contrast.
Please.
Because Luke is telling a story of Jesus handing his life over for us, right? And in that doesn't mean that Judas's handing over doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that any of this other, it means that all of these other things, these other actions are of greater importance. You know, we tend to say that if, you know, the work, that the acts of Jesus render our acts unimportant. But the way you're presenting it, it renders them eternally important. Mm-hmm. And that all of the other handing overs that happen within the story of Jesus handing over his life are of, I mean, they become loaded with significance. So, thank you for that.
Yeah, and it does sort of come to a head then with the betrayal being, you know, the betrayal being sort of the focus of the Eucharist, right? Or as the context of the Eucharist, because you have Judas is betraying, but then you have Jesus giving over his body. You know, he takes the cup and says, you know, gives the bread to the disciples and says, "Take, eat, take, drink. This is my body given for you." And that's the same root verb there. So, you know, that contrast is coming to a head here in the Eucharist, which again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about the ritual and the liturgical enactment of these stories, that when we encounter the Eucharist, when we go to the altar, it's not like we're playing dress up and reenacting, you know, the Last Supper. It's that we are continuing in Christ's command, and receiving exactly what the disciples received, which is his very self.
And what are the other texts going to say about this, Ethan? Sorry to interrupt this.
Well, so when you go through the readings, will you do the Old Testament and the Epistle reading as well?
I don't know. I'm no longer responsible for it, so all I can do is go to church and then criticize what the other people do.
All right, sounds good. they're short readings, but I think they're key readings. That what you have, what I see in both of them is, in the epistle, of course, you have from Philippians 2, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. So you have the image of the hand, right, reaching out and grasping out for equality with God, right? And that's, you know, that's embodied by that is embodied by Judas, this greed and selfishness that seeks to usurp God. And so you have rather Christ making himself nothing, right? Taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So you have the Christ pouring himself out, right? And that becomes sort of the in one hand we reflect the self-giving nature of Christ, and yet at the same time, in the passage from Deuteronomy, the Old Testament lesson.
Okay, can I just say that is such a good point that, you know, Paul is saying that what Jesus was doing just contrasts so the polar opposite of everything else that is going on in the story of salvation. Everyone else is grasping, and he's not, you know? Right. And what a great inflection point to understand this. You know, it's a long reading, but Paul sifts it down and says it's a reading of contrast. This is why we need to be saved, because no one else is doing this. So,
right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's important to keep these readings in both the Old Testament and the Epistle, because the Old Testament also has this language of the hand, but it's more in the sense that that God is declaring none can deliver out of my hand, right? It's after this perhaps a little uncomfortable statement where God says, I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal. There is none that can deliver out of my hand. I think what you have there is an acknowledgement that all of this, even our own, everything that we experience, right, so when it feels like things are being taken away from us, that even God has a hand in that. But at the same time, it's always moving toward resurrection, right? It's he might kill, you know, even though he slay me, you know, as Job says, you know, even though I am killed, I am made alive. Christ, God wounds and he heals, so that, you know, and I'm not exactly sure how this fits in with the handing over, right? Especially when it's something that might be imposed on us. But I think there's at least the comfort of the fact that we're always in the hand of God, right? None can deliver out of God's hand, and that might sound like a threat, but for those who believe and trust in him, I believe have the peace and comfort that they're in his protecting hand.
I have a question about that. Jesus doesn't seem to take much comfort in being in God's hands when he's saying, you know, let this cup pass from me. This is God's hand seemed to be a very cruel place to be, but he then says, "Not my will, but thine be done," and so, I mean, I don't want to brush over the fact that of what Luke records is that this was not, you know, Jesus didn't go skipping off into the cross without without the whole weight of the passion on him. And so, you know, again, you pointed out, I kill and I make alive. That's not just metaphorical. That's actually happening, you know.
Right,
Jesus appeals to the Father and says, you know, get me out of this. And it doesn't happen. And so God is, in a sense, the cause of Jesus' death. But then it's all changed. It's, yeah, I mean, well, I know what if I was at your service, I would say, do you have to have all of these readings? And then, of course, you would say yes, and here's why. But you won't be able to tell that to your congregation.
Right. Well, to go back to your your question about, or your point about Jesus, you know, not being comfortable in the hand of God, I think what's helpful is to go back to that word betrayal and the word handing over, because there's another sense of the word that might shed a little bit different light. Because usually we think about betrayal or handing over as sort of an instantaneous thing, right? Like a prisoner being handed over to the jailer. But in the word is also used in Greco-Roman literature as a child being entrusted to a tutor. So a child is handed over to the tutor, and then that child is, you know, he's betrayed in a sense, right? He's stuck with this teacher, but that tutor is going to discipline and educate and lead this child along the way, so that it is a you know, almost raising them up in the art of handing oneself over, over the long haul. So it's not just so this handing over isn't just an instantaneous thing, but something that happens in the long haul. And I think it forces us to pay attention, to what the moment of betrayal forces us to pay attention, right? Because it seems like Judas' betrayal comes out of left field, right? That how could this happen? How could one of his 12? And so you're forced to turn your attention back at everything that's led up to this point. And in many ways, all of Lent has been a push to do that, right? To draw our attention to the ways that we have rejected God and have departed from his will, and we're being called back, right? Called back, you know, led back by the tutor back into the way, so that we can then continue forward. So this we're sort of looking two ways in one sense in Holy Week, right? The betrayal forces us to look back at the own ways that we have either betrayed God, or, you know, how we had this ongoing back and forth, right? Where we betray God, but he calls us back. And then it also turns us forward to look to the cross and to the resurrection, right? Where there is that, you know, that exchange in our favor, right? Where finally we are led into the fullness of life.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.